most profound sound chambers are definitely the lady chapels of certain European Gothic cathedrals. They are acoustically so incredibly well constructed. I'm not sure that we would have the expertise today with all of our technology and machinery to replicate them, to be honest with you. They seem to be, in their construction, a certain innate knowing within the craftsmen building them that led to them to be so, frankly, acoustically perfect. So that's an interesting thing in itself, because faith drove that. So the religious part drove the science. We no longer have pure science as a study at universities. It's now applied science. And what I mean by that is that applied science is it's applied to making profit. Okay, so it's become very corporate. Pure science was science for the sheer hell of it. Christ enthroned. But he's enthroned in a standing waveform called a mandorla, you know, an almond, okay? And what you've got there is Jesus as portrayed at the opening of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. So God is portrayed as a standing waveform, in other words, acoustically. If you go to Sharp Cathedral, for instance, the resonant frequency is about 117 hertz, 0.4589, and so on and so forth. And you get that everywhere in the world, but not at Giza. At Giza, you walk in and it's 125 hertz, 0.0000. You're halfway up the Grand Gallery, it's 250 hertz, 0.000, recurring, okay? And then up to the top, 500 hertz, and so on and so forth. It's just perfect. It's spooky. And here we have in the glass the empty space, and below the line we've got full space. But this line defining the two is the viscous. I think that humanity is that viscous. You try and shut down your eyes from moving. There's about 2,000 muscles, about 40,000 movements per second, okay? As soon as you start to still that, the world before you dissolves. It just goes white. So what is reality? If everything is quantum movement, if everything is particles and sound, what is reality? It's got to be consciousness. Go down to the quantum level, we think that we're solid, but we're not, because everything's moving. Everything. It's just particle spin everywhere. At that point, I was gone. I was no longer me, I was no longer in my body, I was up there with the angels, and I was, you know, it was a fantastical state. I felt I knew everything at once. We ended up with hieroglyphs, the Eye of Horus, the Ankh, the Key of Life. We ended up with the backbone of Osiris, the double Eye of Horus, which is the Nebe-Jur, and is the secret holy name of the Egyptian god, which had never been seen before in such a circumstance. And there's much more.
And you've got images of this, right? Because you presented it. I can put images up on screen. There'll be images on screen for everyone watching and listening of that. This is it. So this suggests, I mean, that's basically saying that the elements of the hieroglyphic alphabet are actually cymatic signatures of fundamental harmonics.
All languages. We've done tests all over the world, and basically, wherever we've gone and performed these cymatic tests and smoke tests as well, they always give us the script of the earliest part of that civilization.
I'm particularly excited to have this talk. So today I've got David Elkington on. He's a historian rooted in ancient religions, best known for his groundbreaking exploration of sound as a sacred science across prehistory and early civilizations, which is a topic that many of you will know I've become pretty obsessed with over the last few years. David's work, most notably outlined in his book, The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, reveals how sites like the Great Pyramid, Stonehenge, Newgrange, and many others were meticulously designed to resonate at frequencies matching the Earth's natural resonances and even human alpha brainwaves. His research is built upon real experiments and acoustic modeling, showing that chanting, architecture, and the intentional placement of megalithic structures amplified resonance to alter states of consciousness and perhaps shaped the origins of early religious traditions. David has lectured at Oxford and Cambridge, appeared on Forbidden History, and continues to challenge the conventional narrative by demonstrating that acoustic science was a foundational technology of the ancients. David, it's a pleasure to have you on.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Jay. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, we met briefly at a private event in England, which was fantastic. You gave a very detailed presentation of your travels and research into this ancient science of acoustics. And you described yourself as a recovering academic. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I've had my ups and downs with academe over the past 20, 30 years or so. And I've come very swiftly to the conclusion, particularly in the past 18 years, that academe is actually way behind the times and that it's stuck within its own conditioning and its conformity. And if we really want to find out about what really happened, academe and academic works are a great place to start, but it's a starting point. It's not the finishing point. And we have to go further and faster because we live in changing times. We've got to challenge everything they say. And in fact, I'd go further. We have to challenge ourselves and what we think we believe. So it's a matter of trying to break your conditioning so that you can break forward almost into a wider conditioning where things begin to connect more and therefore lead to a greater sense of understanding and, dare I say it, wisdom. And I mean that in the ancient sense of the word.
Absolutely. And where did this fascination with specifically acoustics and the evidence of their presence in a sophisticated, scientific manner in the ancient past start for you? How did you find yourself focusing in on this incredibly fascinating but often, as you said, overlooked avenue of research?
Well, I'm specifically interested in the origins of language in terms of the way we write language, in terms of script. It's fascinating to me that we have got a largely academic community dismissing symbolism within myth and within our everyday lives, and yet the very writing they're using is symbolic. So I'm interested into how as to how those symbols came about, and I'm interested in the whole idea of the sacred communion within language, which shows us and teaches us how to commune with the wider world outside as well as with each other. So I come from a an Anglo-Irish family, so obviously I have a bit of both in my genome, and of course the Irish side of me likes to talk, it likes to tell jokes. Very bad jokes, I hasten to add. And it likes to actually utilize language in its full lyrical, rhythmic way to get itself across, which is probably why the Irish have done so well over the years. Something happened to me in 1983. I just left art school and I had basically just parted ways with the girlfriend who at that time was the love of my life. I was in a pretty miserable state. I was actually quite heartbroken. I'm grateful to her because in breaking my heart, she woke me up. But that was a thank you that was to come many years later. And it was, exactly. You know, it's the classic case of the poet, you know. So there I was on the Somerset levels in Wells. And it was the run-up for Christmas. I'd no idea who I was, where I was, and where I was heading. And then I took the fateful step of walking into the cathedral. Gothic cathedrals are simply wonderful, wonderful places. And it's an awful tragedy that the church today has forgotten how to use them properly. And at this period, I then sort of walked through and was completely amazed by it, but still actually pretty much self-obsessed with what had just happened. And then I took the left-hand side of the wall to walk through. I was a bit sort of too shy to walk directly through the centre of the nave. And I saw this door, and it said, to the chapter house. And I opened the door, and what was there before me was just wonderful. It was just this extraordinary spiral staircase with very, very heavily worn steps that had been obviously worn over a period of almost 1,000 years. And it was just a glory, actually. And then I thought, I'm just going to go up and have a look. And I got halfway up when suddenly, unaware of the fact that the choir were actually practicing for the carol concert, they broke out into some medieval hymn. And at that point, I was gone. I was no longer me. I was no longer in my body. I was up there with the angels, and I was, you know, it was a fantastical state. I felt I knew everything at once. It really had the most profound effect upon me. And that's a complete understatement. I don't know.
A transcendental state.
Yes, it was. It was exactly that. But here's the interesting part. And I was only to learn this later. It was very similar to the near-death experience. A near-death experience which I had 12 years later when my thyroid gland collapsed and I found myself in a very deeply comatose state, and actually died for a short period of time and had to be revived. So the two were very, very similar, if not the same. So when I came down from this experience, I don't know how long it was. It seemed like hours, but obviously it was seconds. I found myself a complete emotional ruin, because the music had just done that to me. And when I came out of that that experience, I walked back into the nave. I suddenly knew what I was going to do. I was going to find out the origin and the source of what the hell had happened to me.
Or what the heaven had happened to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although, I mean, in defense of Greek, the word hell, of course, is a verb meaning to transform, which is exactly what had happened.
Good bit of trivia there for everyone.
Yeah. And also, you know, the saying, if you're going through hell, it means you're obviously going through transformation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, so yes, you're going through the tunnel. Mm-hmm. You see the light at the end of the tunnel. All I would say is linger long enough to make sure it's not another oncoming train.
Would you attribute this this experience, obviously, and this is something that's shared by many people, myself included, because I've had some very strange paranormal level experiences in my life that were off of the back of my own personal traumas and things that were happening in my life at that time, and then a miraculous event, a radical catalyst of some form, enters your experience of life and changes your direction, changes your perception. This occurred for you in this Gothic cathedral. Do you think that it was the acoustics of that choir and the engineering of that structure that facilitated this?
That's what I wanted to find out, although that wasn't the question I asked myself at the time, because I knew nothing about acoustics. It was only when I started reading further and having further experiences that I realized it had to be down to the sound. And then when I started looking at that and looking at the physics behind it, it was just breathtaking. And then I discovered that, thanks to the work of others, that, you know, there are four main brainwave frequencies for us, and that the main one, the alpha rhythm, is approximately 17 to 13 hertz, or vibrations per second. So we go into that state quite often twice a day. We go into it when we're going into and coming out of sleep. So the everyday vibration we're working at is a lot faster. But when you go into an alpha state, you suddenly descend because you're relaxing. The body is getting ready for sleep. So they say that if you've got a problem, you should actually sleep on it, because what happens is you go into an alpha state, and at that point, the brain's ability to perceive much more widely happens. So imagine a puddle of water and you drop some oil on it. Suddenly it goes vroom. That's what happens to you in an alpha state. Suddenly you can make connections that you wouldn't normally make in your normal everyday working brain rhythm. So suddenly I could understand why, as a painter, as an artist, I could understand why it was I could go into these trance-like states and produce pieces of work which, even to me, were a wonder. And I could understand then why others did the same thing. And of course, one of the greatest examples is the chemist Mendeleev, who actually had a dream in which he saw the periodic table, and then woke up the next morning, and all he had to do was to write it down. it was the classic alpha state experience.
And I mean, what amazes me and is often discredited and disregarded by science, which I find ironic, because so often you find that these people are represented as the kind of the hallmarks of scientific brilliance, whether it's Tesla or Einstein or René Descartes, or, you know, a good example is Augustus Kekulé, who drew out the benzene ring. He had this vision of the Ouroboric serpent in his dream where it was eating its tail, and that's how he came up with the benzene ring. Or René Descartes, who in a feverish dream in a barnyard in Prague was visited by some angelic being that told him that measurement and number are the reasons for the universe, and this gave him the ideas that founded kind of Cartesian rationalism. And then that's used to discount the paranormal, which is such ironic kind of behavior. You know, these ideas that are then cemented into place and concretized by those that weren't so brilliant disregard how that brilliance even came into being, because it came into being through anomalous ways, came into being through strange visions and prophetic ideas. And where does that information come from? You know, this quantum field and the Akashic record.
Yes, this is deeply ironic because, of course, science came out of religion. If we hadn't had the schism of the two in the early church, in the early medieval church, and so on, then we would still have science and religion together, which means that we would see ourselves as we truly are, as the technology. But now what we have is we have a separate religious spiritual belief, and we have a technology that's out there. Here is a phone. You know, I'm using this to contact my friends. I'm using it via my voice. My voice is the true technology. This merely is the arbiter. This is the priest in modern parlance. It is the communicant between myself and you, or as we're talking today, on my laptop. But actually, we are the technology. And this is what annoys me about modern technology today. It's all out there, but it's not in here. We dismiss what's in here, but we do so at our peril. And of course, we make discoveries in order to then drop back into our comfort zone. But the problem is that we no longer have pure science as a study at universities. It's now applied science. And what I mean by that is that applied science is it's applied to making profit. Okay, so it's become very corporate. Pure science was science for the sheer hell of it. And what came out of pure science is what has got us here today. So you know, what we're looking at here is a specific kind of a road or sense of where we're going, but it's not really where we want to be in large part.
I'd love to get your opinion on some of the best examples of acoustic engineering in the ancient past. What are the most prominent examples in your mind that demonstrate levels of advancement that contradict the current models that we have for development during Neolithic periods and Bronze Age periods? There's some places that I've become very interested in. I'd love to know what are kind of the top ones on your list.
Well, it's a very interesting question. You should ask that because the most profound sound chambers are definitely the lady chapels of certain European Gothic cathedrals. They are acoustically so incredibly well constructed. I'm not sure that we would have the expertise today with all of our technology and machinery to replicate them, to be honest with you. They seem to be, in their construction, a certain innate knowing within the craftsmen building them that led to them to be so, frankly, acoustically perfect. So that's an interesting thing in itself, because faith drove that. So the religious part drove the science, and as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And the Freemasons were often involved with the construction of these temples, these Gothic cathedrals, correct?
Well, it was the stonemasons for sure, who later on led to, you know, their guilds later on became, I think, Freemasonry, to preserve their knowledge, definitely. Because of course,
yeah, I mean, would you argue that this is almost like the Gothic cathedrals are almost like a refined example of this lineage that we see going all the way back into prehistory with these megalithic examples?
Definitely. That's undoubtedly the case. I mean, you know, the word Gothic comes from the philological source Guth, G-U-T-H, which in Proto-Indo-European means voice. So you're going into the Gothic, and what you're looking at is, and what you're experiencing is the voice. And what's fascinating about this is that even before you enter the cathedral, you have to go under the portal, which is itself pyramidal, okay? And under the pyramid is an arch, which is the entrance through the double doors. But in the pyramid, called the tympanum, which basically in Greek and Latin means a drum skin, in other words, vibration. And on that, you will see Christ enthroned. But he's enthroned in a standing waveform called a mandorla, an almond, okay? And what you've got there is Jesus as portrayed at the opening of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. So God is portrayed as a standing waveform, in other words, acoustically. Now, if you take that mandorla, take out the figure of Jesus for the moment, and rest it as a on the horizontal, you have this Vesica Pisces shape. That is actually the Egyptian glyph going back many thousands of years for primordial scission. In other words, everything coming out of nothing. It's the mystery of creation. And it's all to do with rhythmic vibration. So you have here a continual and continuous tradition and logic talking about sound that is actually hidden within all of these teachings, these societies, etc., and even within church liturgy.
You say that the Gothic cathedrals are almost a representation of if not a form of mastery, at least getting pretty close in terms of what they were trying to achieve all the way through history. But what about the pyramids of Giza, the Great Pyramid? Would you consider that on a similar scale? Because that's pretty precise.
Yeah, I mean that was going to be the shining example of my, you just, what can I say? The pyramid is beyond superlative. The King's Chamber is by far and away the most acoustically perfect chamber ever. And absolutely, definitely, we do not know how on earth those people, as we can see them through archaeology and through our historical understanding, could possibly have constructed it so perfectly. John Reed did some acoustical work there back in 1998, and others have since done the same work. And I mean, if you go to Chartres Cathedral, for instance, the resonant frequency is about 117 hertz, 0.4589, and so on and so forth. And you get that everywhere in the world, but not at Giza. At Giza, you walk in and it's 125 hertz, 0.0000. You're halfway up the Grand Gallery, it's 250 hertz, 0.0000 recurring, okay? And then up to the top, 500 hertz, and so on and so forth. It's just perfect. It's spooky. I mean, it's like there was somebody else here. It wasn't us.
So it's tuned to a perfect acoustic scale.
Yes.
I hope people can understand how mind-blowing that is when you also add in all of the incredible sophisticated engineering and the multi-ton blocks. Like, there's so many things to be mind-blown about with the pyramids, but they're also acoustically tuned perfectly.
Yes. This is what's so utterly astonishing about them. And you kind of think, my goodness me, we are in a completely different realm here. This is like we've kind of emerged from a black hole into a new universe, and suddenly you're faced with the impossible, but it's there. It's not impossible. It's been done. So you kind of think, goodness me. And then you kind of look at these places, and then you have to then look at the mythology surrounding them, who they're dedicated to, why, and what that is going to tell us. And that's even more revealing. And of course, the pyramid is sometimes called the tomb of Osiris, the Egyptian hero god. It's fascinating because Osiris is actually a Greek translation of his original name, which is Asar, spelled Asar. But you couldn't really, in ancient Egypt, start the name of a god with the vowel. The vowel is the secret holy bit, it's the powerful bit. To start like that is to do an impersonation of God, and that's blasphemous. So you've got to start it by hopping on the bus, which is the consonant. And generally, he was called Yesa or Yesu. Okay. What's fascinating is that the pyramid was also, according to I.E.S. Edwards, the late great Egyptologist, it was labeled the place of the ascension. So again, we have some rather interesting correlations there with a certain religion that we know very much of. Second to that, it's also just outside the city of Cairo. Cairo is never given its proper credit for its place in the scheme of things, because Cairo, of course, is a symbol that Constantine the Great saw on the eve of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which led to his defeat of the forces of the Roman Emperor, his co-emperor Maxentius. And of course, in the immediate aftermath of that, Constantine issued a decree accepting Christianity as the religion of the empire. And so this symbol he saw was the Cairo. So it's, again, you know, another curious thing here, which is linked to the hero god. It's linked to Mithras, it's linked to Jesus, it's linked to Dionysius and others. And then we go back even further in Egyptian mythology, and we see the goddess Isis, who was known as the Beloved in Egyptian mythology. Beloved in Egyptian is Mary, M-E-R-Y. So suddenly we're looking at the source point of things. And of course, the pyramid is also called the womb of Isis. And if you look at the pyramid text, I think it's number 632, it gives you instructions to look at the pyramid at dawn from a certain angle. Now, obviously, all you're going to see are walls, as this thing, you know, presents itself before you. But if you look at the pyramid transparently, you find that all of the inner chambers come together to give you the outline of the mummified Osiris in the womb of Isis. So obviously the pyramid was the place of rebirth. And how interesting that John discovered that the sarcophagus in the king's chamber, it actually resonates. I think it's to 2.4 megahertz, which is basically the beat of a newborn baby's heart.
I mean, at a certain point, it's almost just funny, isn't it? The amount of compounding, ridiculous engineering feats that are being put into one singular construct. And you had some pretty incredible experiences in the Pyramids of Giza, including a resonance experiment in the King's Chamber, correct? Where you had some cymatic patterns appearing that were incredibly interesting.
John's work again. Yeah, John's work again. He was in the pyramid. He did these tests on the sarcophagus. He placed a speaker underneath a membrane which had desert sand from just outside the pyramid scattered across it. I should say here at this point here that desert sand in Egypt is different from desert sand here in the UK and Western Europe. Here in Western Europe, it's all very fragmentary and chipped. If you want to move anything on it, it's very, very unlikely you're going to get very far. In Egypt, what you've got is literally trillions upon trillions of ball bearings. So you can move rock on it actually with some ease. So obviously using that for sound is going to have a transformative effect. And when John did the test, he threw the internal frequencies of the pyramid at the membrane. We ended up with hieroglyphs, the Eye of Horus, the Ankh, the Key of Life. We ended up with the backbone of Osiris, the double Eye of Horus, which is the Neb-er-Jur, and is the secret holy name of the Egyptian god, which had never been seen before in such a circumstance. And there's much more.
And you've got images of this, right? Because you presented it. I can put images up on screen. There'll be images on screen for everyone watching and listening of that. This is it. So this suggests, I mean, that's basically saying that the elements of the hieroglyphic alphabet are actually cymatic signatures of fundamental harmonics.
All languages. We've done tests all over the world, and basically wherever we've gone and performed these cymatic tests, and smoke tests as well, they always give us the script of the earliest part of that civilization.
In India, my God, that's incredible.
Yeah, in India we had the Om, in Western England, Ireland, we had Celtic knotwork and so on and so forth. And another thing you should know, by the way, in terms of the preservation of this in liturgies, particularly within the church, particularly in the Catholic Church, is that you could do this using smoke. And I'd like to go back to Egypt and do these again with a good film team.
Come with us. We've got me and a buddy are going out on the 10th of July.
I'd love to do it. I really would love to do it. And do it with laser lights and get proper smoke.
Mm.
Because the only smoke you can use with a molecule large enough to give you the definition is frankincense.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
what?
Yeah. And in fact, we've shown as well that frankincense smoke actually, under certain acoustic conditions, takes exactly the forms and shapes of pineals and everything else that you'll see on Gothic architecture.
Oh my
God. If you're wondering where the architecture comes from, it comes from the actual sound wave frequencies themselves.
Well, this is the thing I've pointed out on the channel a lot, as well as, you know, when you start researching this, you walk into churches and cathedrals and temples with a different set of eyeballs, because you start looking at these geometries, you start looking at these beautiful patterns, which objectively to anyone, no matter what level of education you have, are stunning. But when you realize that so many of them are match for match on these cymatic acoustic vibrations, these fundamental geometries, you start realizing that there is a secret, like you said, like a sound science that's encoded into the architecture, into the visuals, into the motifs.
And into the language used as
well. Yeah, into the language.
And this is the important point, because, you know, the churches are doing us a huge favor in preserving this knowledge, because otherwise it would have been lost. And where would we be?
They're not telling us about it.
No, because unfortunately now priests and others are very ignorant about not only the history of their churches, but on how to use them. One of the most depressing things I have ever witnessed was, I was living in Bath about 20 years ago.
Oh yeah, I remember you saying about this.
And I went to the local church to take part in the carol service. Now, you know, I can't really say I'm a practicing Christian, but I love the story of Christmas because it talks about the mother and child. It talks about the fragility of life on earth. I think it's very symbolic of that. And I think to go and pay your devotions to that is to honor life itself. And then to walk into a church that was built in the 1100s to find the vicar using a Bluetooth with all of the necessary feedback was just so utterly depressing. I had
completely oblivious to the building he's standing in.
Well, I'm afraid to say it was she. And
she.
I went to the pub afterwards and got uproariously drunk. I was that.
Tried to forget about it.
And if you look at the Gothic arch and then go to the mirror in the morning and look at the back of your throat, you've got the same thing. So it's a monument to the human voice. And the church is all about theatre and drama. And the hero god himself is the originator of theatre and drama, because there were four main principles in the Greek setup of ritual: theatre, drama, comedy, and liturgy, along with tragedy. Okay, so you know, this is the problem: is that we've gone forward in our civilization, but we've lost contact with the past, and this is it's an ongoing pattern, because I think that when we came out of the caves in deep prehistory, if that's where we were, it's interesting that the very first thing we did was not to build schools, shops, or whatever. We built the sacred place. Why? Well, you go into the sacred place, you see what happens to your brainwave frequencies, you go into these changed brainwave states, and it's kind of like you're talking to the mother earth herself. So in a sense, there, it's like, you know, when you send your eldest child to university, the last thing you say before they get in the car or on the train is, remember to stay in touch. And that's what we do when we go into temples, pyramids, cathedrals. We're staying in contact with our home planet, but in a much more direct way. And it's a great tragedy that we've lost that contact with the sacred place under those terms.
Yeah, it's a travesty that these places that were designed for a visceral, objectively experienceable feeling of transcendence, of divinity, of connection. Although, of course, many people will still have these experiences in these places, and I'm not taking away from that, certainly not. But the true intention and goal. Like you said, even the people who are presiding over these buildings do not have the knowledge. So where did it go? Because this was deliberately created for serving this function. At what point in history did this begin to fall away from knowledge? How much of it is sitting in the apostolic archives under the Vatican courtyards, and how much of it is simply lost to time? And, is it mainly suppression or general ignorance and raiding and looting and pillaging over the years? What do you think is the definitive factor for this amnesia to the acoustics?
I think it's a matter of all of those factors, Frank. But I think actually, more shockingly, in the West, I think it's just down to pure ignorance. The rise of ignorance in our society today, the rise of ignorance in our society today is terrible because we have social media now. People are being fed information which is largely inaccurate, and they're not actually questioning where they're at, what they're doing, what they're seeing. We need to do more of that. We need to challenge that consensus. You go into churches and cathedrals, you'll see this extraordinarily beautiful phenomenon, quite often labeled as being pagan. It's called the Green Man. It's a man who is disgorging leaves and branches from his mouth, sometimes his eyes, sometimes his ears. Sometimes it comes in the form of green women too. And what you're looking at here is not something that's pagan at all. If it was pagan, what the dickens would it be doing in the holiest places of churches and cathedrals? Nobody asks the obvious question. And of course, what's coming out of the mouth is creation itself. It's the way the word is manifesting. So you've got here the survival of an ancient liturgy, which is saying to you, respect everything. Know yourself. And this is the problem. The world's become a pretty dark place since the end of the Second World War, and we're now moving away from a sense of wonder in things around us and more a sense of wonder into the latest technology, which is actually only an interface when you think about it.
Do you think that there's a potential, because you're right, that essentially it feels, at least in the modern human world, regardless of indigenous tribes that are just trying to live their lives and do their things, like the trajectory of humanity is technologically driven. Could it be that we may be able to find that deeper connection through technology? I mean, the deeper we probe into the quantum realm, we're kind of beginning to discover things that feel mystical and esoteric, and scientists are struggling to bring this into their fundamental and kind of more materialistic worldview. We are on a shifting knife's edge in a lot of different sectors, and I would say especially in the kind of fundamental physics region, being accelerated by AI and quantum computational capabilities. Could we maybe, in a strange way, bring back that archaic knowledge through the medium of our feverish obsession with technology?
I'm really confident about the future because I think it's going to come bursting back.
It already feels like it is a bit poking its head up.
You kind of like I think we're seeing a bit of a wasteland at the moment, but you're seeing the cracks in the ground, which are telling you about incipient growth. And I think it's going to burst upon the scene as soon as we actually determine who we are, where we are, and we reform our largely decrepit political systems. This is the new growth area, and let's not forget now that we've come to the next industrial revolution, which is consciousness. Everybody wants to know, and it's fascinating. And I do believe that, I'm in my early 60s. I hate to admit that, but it's true. And when I was at school, I was taught that the Aborigines in Australia, because that's where I was educated in my early life, they were primitives, okay? And sometimes they were called savages. But that wasn't my experience of being with them. I thought they were very profound.
You might have to double back and give people a bit more of a background, because it's actually very interesting, your upbringing.
Yeah, I my parents were basically Royal Naval, and they scuppered to Australia back in the early 60s, and I spent a lot of my time there with the so-called native peoples, and I had very profound experiences with them. These were really beautiful, lovely, lovely people, and I couldn't understand the racism and the xenophobia against them. And the older I started getting, the more I started questioning this whole idea of them being savages, or as they say in the history books, right up to the 1950s, heathens, you know, as if Christianity is the be all and end all, and we won, thank you very much. Because these people were preserving and still are preserving age-old wisdom, which is now emerging. And F. David Peet, spelt Peat, wrote a wonderful book about 25, 30 years back called Blackfoot Physics, in which he discusses the whole idea of how the Blackfoot have actually preserved this underlying knowledge of physics in its classical form in the Western world, except that they had it before us. And that takes you back to the whole idea of the Aboriginal dream time, what's it to do with consciousness. And of course, you know, you can change immediately people's perceptions of this by their understanding of words. Words are the archaeology of human consciousness to a large degree. Okay. So if I say to you one word, give me your impression that you get in your mind straight away, primitive.
Feral or simple, but my understanding of primitive has changed drastically in the last 3 years. But yeah, like simple, simplistic.
Bearskin clad club, and
Yeah.
then words ugh, no,
Ooh,
not
I made fire.
yeah. Okay, now look in the dictionary, and primitive is actually an extraordinary word, because all it means is first born. So how does that change your perception? It takes you immediately into the world of innocence and the world of incipient knowledge, which is exactly what you've got with the Aboriginal dream time. See, so now you can come forward a bit from many tens of thousands of years BC to the individual known as Democritus, a Greek philosopher circa 300 BC, who is given the credit for the discovery of the atom. Now, Democritus, to be fair to him, says he had it from a chap called Moschus, a Phoenician. And the difference in the two is that Democritus says that the atom is not divisible. But Moschus, who lived quite a few hundred years before Democritus, said, oh, yes, it's divisible. Goodness me, how did he know? How did he know? So we I think history doesn't go in a linear way. I think it goes in a spiral way. And for every turn of the spiral, when we geolocate it, we're merely reflecting what came before on the spiral down below and what's going to come on the spiral above. And I think we dismiss the ancients at our peril, and to look down upon them in this patronizing way is to actually it's to deny knowledge. It's to deny wisdom.
That spiral that you just described can actually be applied in quite real terms when you think of these amazing temples and structures around the world that we can attribute to a certain culture. But then, lo and behold, below them, there is a subterranean complex that's older and more advanced and more mysterious. And many of the oral traditions, whether it's Peru or Turkey or Egypt, will speak of a lost civilization, an old kingdom, a lost kingdom. And it's very interesting that the further we get back in time, we seem to be more advanced. That's a serious contradiction that keeps occurring, whether it's the stonework or the acoustics, which are often married together anyway. You know, it's often this incredible package of advanced multivariate knowledge. You know, it's not just one thing. It's mathematics, it's acoustics, it's astronomy, it's geometry, it's multi-ton stonework leveraging and quarrying and cutting. Like, there are so many different things, and yet some of the best examples sit at what is apparently, like you said, the primal, the primitive, the Stone Age, the Neolithic. How do we explain that? I mean, there are lots of theories, and a lot of people would be leaning more towards the idea that this perhaps is the attempt to rebuild after a cataclysm, or some of the evidence of a cataclysm that did survive. Where do you sit on these ideas? Where do you think the origin point, the seed for this incredible knowledge set comes from?
I think the answer is very easily encapsulated in one word: innocence. If we look at the primal creation legends, humanity, when first created, is innocent. And when you're in the state of innocence, an awful lot can come through. It's a typical modern paradigm that we think that because ancient civilizations seem to begin at the most advanced stage and then descend, that therefore there must have been something before it. Now, I'm not denying that that's the case, but what I'm saying is we have to be very careful in our application of it, because I think that at the beginning, if we look at the instance of the shaman, again, a figure who runs through the whole of history, including Jesus Christ upon the cross, okay, he's bringing down knowledge. We still have that phenomenon in the Far East and elsewhere. We have male and female shamans doing exactly the same thing. If you can actually gear that knowledge in an advanced way, there's no telling what you can bring down. Now, if therefore we're actually predicating our existence, as I believe ancient Egypt did, upon the idea of consciousness, that everything is conscious, then it's all there for you to take advantage of. It's just a case of communing with it and then bringing it down. And I find that a fascinating phenomenon about ancient civilizations. They all begin at a peak and then slowly descend. And you get that with the Gothic. Suddenly, you know, we have the Dark Age period. It's a period of massive internecine strife. Learning has gone, you know, has just gone into the bin. There's just feudal wars everywhere. And then suddenly we have the rise of the Gothic. Shortly after the rise of the Gothic, people were going into these extraordinary places and their brainwave frequencies were being transformed. Well, whoopee-doo, next thing you've got is the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. We give ourselves the credit. We should be giving the credit to the builders of these places who knew what they were doing. And this is the thing, is we are the technology. We don't know how the pyramids were constructed because, you know, once the starting gun was the trigger was pulled, bang, one 2.5-ton stone would have to have been put in place every 2 minutes, approximately, in order to build that within the 20-year time period that we know it took. So how do we actually rationalize that? Well, perhaps we should actually irrationalize it. We should start using logic not to limit our view of the universe, but to expand it. And in doing that, therefore, we need to make the connections to widen our thinking and then see that if we are the technology, then perhaps we got ourselves into a particular state where organization and an organized view of consciousness could actually erect these things. And I mean, I'll give you a very simplistic example. It's in my book, The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound. A lady driving along with her two very young children in the back of the car in the countryside somewhere. Suddenly there's an accident. Her car turns over and goes into a ditch. The children are trapped. There's water in the ditch. They're in danger of drowning. In that moment, her endorphin level is so flooded, she's able to lift up a 2.5-ton vehicle to release the children. Now, we have many examples of that. So now we come to the issue of drugs and so-called leisure drugs. There's no such thing as a leisure drug. I'm against drug usage for leisure. I think it's an evil that we can do without. But however, if you want to control drug usage, then it might be a more enlightened approach to show people how to take the things properly. Because it's fairly obvious that in ancient civilizations, drugs were taken to actually heighten your consciousness and to draw down knowledge as a means to help you to control your whole hormonal output. And we see this with DMT users and others. You know, the world becomes suddenly a very expanded sense of consciousness. And within that, you know everything. If you can retain parts of that and bring it back, then you can use it for the rise of civilization. And I believe that's profoundly, that's what happened.
I think you touched on some incredibly important points there. And very intriguing the way you looked at it in regards to innocence and an open mind and a different state of consciousness, like the child mind. the alpha mind, the mind that actually has that free flow, intuitive information from a higher field of something greater and grander. Nikola Tesla spoke about this, saying that my brain is only a receiver, that there is a core at the center of all things where it all comes from. I have no idea where it is, but I know that it exists. That was Tesla's belief. And I agree with you, and I find it interesting that, you think about psychedelic experiences, near-death experiences, transcendental experiences, and then also a very interesting phenomena that can occur, and a great example of it that you're probably familiar with, where you get this fractal self-similarity. If you get, for example, a camera, like a DSLR camera, and you focus it in and project its output into itself as input, so it's observing itself. What will happen there is you'll get this cascade of geometric patterns that just extend down in infinity. And the more you change the lens, the more these things will shift and change. So it's like when the camera is viewing itself, it falls into this fractal cascade of geometry. I would argue that we do the same thing when we meditate, when we silence the chattering monkey mind, when we get into that space that we call transcendental. It is an observation of the self that allows for this fractal cascade to take place. But the difference maker between us and a camera is we are self-aware, we are conscious, we are able to, in some way, absorb the information from these what seem to be fundamental geometries of reality, whatever that might truly mean at the Planck level and beyond it. But we are conscious and we can observe our inner world. And when we do that, this self-similar fractal recursion happens just as it can be exampled through cameras. And we get insight from this. And this seems to then be represented in, like you said, the temple cymatics, the geometry of the temples, the actual resonance, and the acoustic engineering. So the idea that this came intuitively rather than from alien ambassadors or some advanced civilization, I agree with you, because the intuition, the place where that comes from, seems to be that realm. You know what I mean?
First thing, you mentioned the word alien. I'm left-handed and I'm slightly dyslexic, so I have an ability to see things backwards, and that's what got me about the word alien. In doing this work, I realized that the word alien in the dictionary means foreigner, means stranger. That's all it means. Okay, now obviously that had a greater sense of meaning to ancient peoples, and I think to those who are having these experiences today, it definitely has that deeper meaning. But now, interestingly enough, the word alien actually is an inversion of L-I-N. So the A and the E are swapped around. And what is L-I-N? L-I-N is the 16th letter of the ancient Egyptian, Greek, and Hebrew alphabets. And it's the letter O. And the letter O symbolizes the pineal gland, which is about here. Okay? Just behind the ethmoid bone, which has got a piece of magnetite in it, which gives you your sense of location. So suddenly you're seeing that aliens are actually not out there, they're probably in here. And I would suggest that here is a glass of half-drunk beer, okay? Here we have in the glass the empty space, and below the line we've got full space. But this line defining the two is the viscous. I think that humanity is that viscous. We're neither the empty bit or the full bit, but we are the bit that joins the two in terms of definition. Now, you can be the material bit here, or you can be the spiritual bit here, but our consciousness is that. That, to me, is who we are. Because if you look at the body, we think that we own our bodies. We don't. We are a democracy. Without the candida virus in the gut, you couldn't digest food. Without other, bits and pieces of you which come from elsewhere, including ancient viruses which are now in our DNA, we couldn't, think properly. We probably couldn't digest, certain things. Our bones wouldn't be growing the way they are. We are a democracy, okay? And then we go down to the quantum level. We think that we're solid, but we're not, because everything's moving. Everything. It's just particle spin everywhere. And you can try this. I once sat for a famous portrait painter, and he said, "David, I want you to remain remarkably still." And I got into this, and of course you move slightly because you relax, and then gradually your whole body relaxes, to the point where you can actually feel as if somehow you're exiting parts of your external limbs, you know. It's a weird feeling. But then you try and shut down your eyes from moving. There's about 2,000 muscles, about 40,000 movements per second, okay? As soon as you start to still that, the world before you dissolves. It just goes white. So what is reality? If everything is quantum movement, if everything is particles and sound, what is reality? It's got to be consciousness. And we don't actually focus on that enough to see that actually we are a part of nature. We are neither above it or below it.
I was speaking with Dr. Andrew Gallimore recently, who's the author of several books about dimethyltryptamine, DMT, very fascinating drug, and the experiences that can come from that. And we were discussing this whole idea of, you know, you can almost look at human consciousness in the same sense as the double slit experiment, where you have, you know, a photon or an electron that collapses under observation or measurement, depending on how reductionist you want to be. Like I say, consciousness is likely fundamental, so I would say observer, not measurer. But this idea that the observation of the photon collapses it into this particulate form, you could almost look at your own human waking consciousness as particulate form. You're in this localized expression. You're getting information from your senses of your external environment. All of the data that's giving you an understanding of reality is coming from your localized understanding of what's there. But then when you're not observing that reality, when you're not observing that external stimuli, suddenly you go into these strange realms. You could compare this to the wave function of a photon or an electron, this expansion of mind, this expansion of energy. And perhaps it is the same thing, because one of the most fascinating elements of reality is just how similar it is at micro scale to macro scale. You know, going back to this whole idea of fractal, things just seem to be self-similar at scale, whether it be the swirling of an atomic cloud structure or the swirling of a galaxy. Things just are repeating at larger and larger scales of reality, which would make me say that this feels like in some way a generative, illusionary, non-physical domain that we are just giving a perception of physicality to.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think you're absolutely right. I think we are reflecting fundamentally ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, there's part of the DNA strand that when you look at them on a deeply microscopic level, are extremely similar to the fan vaulting you'll see within cathedrals.
Right, right.
So one thing reflects another. And it's interesting. According to quantum theory, 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, the universe was formed like a tetrahedron, a pyramid.
And then, I don't know how they figured that out.
And then, you know, it's just replicated itself. Well, I put it this way. If there was nothing, as in no thing, and then suddenly you have everything, that is the fundamental mystery. If energy is therefore constrained in the way in which it can actually build itself, having fallen from one particular state into another, then obviously it's going to shroud itself in form. Because naked energy is just... we've seen with atom bombs, an infinite second of singularity where energy is naked is utterly destructive. So energy is seeking to clothe itself. Okay, so I suspect that energy, as Nick Cook said recently, it's not really active, it's probably inactive, it's stillness in motion. It's the fact that it's clothed that has led to the impression of it being active, because what happens is that motion has surrounded stillness. So it's giving the impression of being active. Okay, now, you know, the Buddhists talk about, you know, the finding the one still point. There is no single still point in the whole of the universe, which, by the way, in Latin means one word. So if you're looking for the still point, you're looking to go beyond the universe. But in the meantime, the whole consciousness thing is shrouded in clothing. And God help you if you ask it to strip the clothing away. In the Greek myth of Dionysius, his mother, Semele, having been impregnated by Zeus, asks him to reveal himself as he truly is. And he says, no, 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 I counsel against that. But she insists. So he exposes himself as he truly is, and she's burnt to a cinder within a second. Okay, so it tells you the ancients knew a lot more than we realize. And I think that this is the whole thing with energy, is that if energy is consciousness, then how would consciousness manifest? And hence the alien thing, you see. You've got intermediaries within your own consciousness telling you and guiding you in these ever-changing times as to what's happening and why it's going to happen. This whole idea that UFOs are knocking nuclear missiles out of the sky, as we know has happened on more than a couple of occasions. Is it something within us saying, no, we can't do that? Is it some higher level of our moral spiritual selves saying, no, this is actually intolerable, we can't have that?
Or is it a Cold War black project based on Tesla and T. Townsend Brown technology that was classified before we even knew about it existing? Because there's a few options there, but I agree with you, and it's a very interesting point to make about the power of our own collective consciousness and how that might morph, because that's a very Jungian approach, actually, with the whole idea of a collective consciousness and archetypes, and these kind of like fundamental patterns that are put into our mind, and accessing this from the internal rather than the external being the most revealing. I think this is absolutely a fundamental truth that's echoed through. And like I said, maybe we will be able to in some way evidence these things more empirically through the veil of science. But the clothing of consciousness, I that's a very interesting way of putting it. I've never heard it said that way before.
Well, and also don't forget, you know, we live in a heavily influenced Judeo-Christian society. Okay. And the problem is that, you know, it's been a godsend in many ways, but in others, right here, right now, it seems to me to be a bit, it is slowing us down, because it's conditioned people to think in a particular way. And it's actually led to a kind of strange corporatism where control has now become the main arbiter, not actual exploration. It's quite funny, isn't it, that a lot of the great communist leaders of the 20th century were all of them either reared in seminaries or were at some stage heavy Christians, you know? And I'm not, you know, I don't want to condemn Christianity. I don't want to condemn, you know, the history of that, because that's the way we are. We're now living in an age where we're becoming super aware. The people listening to this podcast would have learnt some amazing things. And what I love about the young particularly is their ability to take this and run with it and not care, because they need to have their experiences, make their mistakes and learn from them and learn wisdom. I think that's fabulous. And if you do that in the present moral climate where, oh, don't do this, don't do that, how are you going to learn? You know, my late grandfather's words to me, he was an Irishman, were some of the wisest I've ever heard. He said to me, my son, we all have our faults. The secret is to be very good at them. And what he meant was that pointless going around the sins that you, because then you don't learn about them. So how can you avoid them? So go into them, enjoy them, learn, move on. It's extraordinary. That's exactly what the ancient world said to you, you should do. We see this with Lucius Apuleius in the story of the golden ass. We see it in Dionysian theatre in ancient Greece. It's all about the tragedy of life, but also the comedy of life. And we have reduced it to a corporate body of nonsense. And we need to break out of that, because to understand the changes we're going through and to therefore get to the future, we must break our own conditioning so we can get into our own consciousness and see those links. And the only advice I can give further to that is, learn to love one another, learn to love language and words, but to understand them properly. Get yourself dictionaries, start looking at those words, where they come from, because they preserve so much of our ancient history. And once you've got that ability to communicate, you also have that ability to commune. And that's very important.
many of the sites across the world that have these acoustic engineering properties seem to also be incorporating like geo-energetic stones into the construction. So materials like quartz, rich granite, which can produce electrical charge naturally through forms of mechanical stress, vibration. And often you will find this paired with limestone, which is known to be a fantastic waveguide for acoustic resonance used by the ancient Romans and Greeks in stadiums and amphitheaters, because limestone seating would carry the voice from the stage all the way to the farthest rows in the back. And so we see this this coupling of limestone and granite and other materials that are complementary across the megalithic world, including, of course, the pyramids on the Giza Plateau. Would you say that that's a novel form of technological fusion being done in the ancient world that we just mistake for simple stonework? Is it coincidental that these happen to be complementary on an energetic level?
Yeah, I read a report on the construction of Newgrange, and it's
blue quartz. Fascinating place.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, blue quartz and white quartz. And the archaeological report said, obviously, this is decorative. And you think, oh, gosh, you know, here we are. And it had nothing to do with it at all. It's to do with the acoustics, because behind that you have, a wall of organic rock, limestone, which absolutely, you know, it acts as a kind of a reflector, in a sense, because you need that to heighten the brainwave aspect of things, to heighten your experience of it. How did they know this? It has to have been knowledge drawn down. When Professor Bob John of Princeton University in the early 90s went to Newgrange, he saw that there were spirals and zigzags carved on the stones of the interior. And it was only when he took out his pipe to smoke it and found that the smoke took exactly the same form that he realized that these people, they were really onto something. And that's what we've had with cymatics. That's what inspired me to go and look at it cymatically. You know, psi, by the way, C-Y of cymatics, meaning in Greek, waveforms, by the way. So, it's all to do with sound. And, you know, it's astonishing. We're now in 2025 and sound is still a primitive technology.
Yeah.
You know, I must tell you something rather amusing. Back in the 50s and 60s, there was a mad French professor called Professor Gavreau. And he noticed the acoustical qualities of a French policeman's whistle. And he thought, well, what he will do is he's going to build one 6 foot long. Now, he did that. And where he got a 6 foot P from, I don't know, but he got the thing in there. And then they were in the laboratory. And he said to his assistant, I'm just going to go behind the screen and do all the measurements. And on the time I say yes, I want you to blow the compressed air through the whistle. And so, of course, he gave the signal. The air was actually released and the assistant dropped down dead on the spot.
What?
When they opened him up on the autopsy table, they found that all of his organs had been liquefied, poor chap.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So this is infrasound. This is the power of infrasound.
My God.
Gavreau, upset, went to the funeral, came out of the funeral, and actually developed a 12-foot version, which developed...
Yes.
I don't want to seem sort of laughing, but if you're against, all these cameras, travel cameras and everything else on our streets, then perhaps you might want to think about putting an acoustic infrasound thing on the bottom of your car.
Oh my God.
It laughs the camera.
Oh my goodness. That's a new story. I'd never heard that before. Never heard that before.
But in all due seriousness, though, I mean, the effect of this, if it can do that to materials, then you're talking here about, you know, in modern speak, in the corporate speak, in the military world, you're talking about a weapon. Okay? I mean, there's no to it. However much you might condemn it, we will turn it effectively into a weapon. But what I'm excited about is the fact that if you had a nuclear bomb coming in, a bit of infrasound could just sort that out straight away. End of story.
Right. Targeted infrasound on these... Yeah. You know, yeah, absolutely. Well, we know that they do have, like, you know, I would say, very rudimentary technology on the surface level publicly, like anti-riot sound-based technology to cause ringing in the ears and things like that. But like you said, I mean, you know, if someone can essentially liquefy someone's organs through frequency, it also speaks to some of these extremely strange ancient sites like Sacsayhuaman and a lot of areas in Peru, but pretty much distributed worldwide. But mostly, I would say, concentrated in Peru, where you have these incredible cyclopean stone building techniques where the stone just seems to be melding into each other like marshmallows that are squished together. And a lot of people would argue either for like a geopolymer mix that they were somehow creating, or perhaps through some very strange knowledge of acoustics, which again is globally distributed in the historical record as something that seems to be present, was somehow liquefying the rock. What do you think about these types of ideas? Do you think it ties into the acoustics that you study?
Yeah, I do.
In terms of the stones?
Very much so. I think it's obviously, as I said, the science is very young. In fact, it's quite primitive.
Right.
Not to be ironic, but it is, because we don't really know much about sound. We haven't paid much attention to it. But again, is it the sound itself? Is it the sound affecting us? Being able to build these things,
right?
I mean, if you go to Baalbek in Lebanon, the temple,
it's on my list.
It's quite staggering, and you kind of think to yourself, "My goodness me!" And top of the King's Chamber, you know, in the so-called relieving chambers, 85-ton blocks of granite.
Taken from how many miles away? Was it like 500 miles from
Aswan? Yes, I mean. You've got the same phenomenon at Stonehenge, for instance. As I said, we need to start looking at this much more closely before judging the ancients and the past in our own terms. It's a terrible modern habit to do that. We kind of, you know, judge them because we want to be seen to be progressive. But actually, it's a terrible insecurity on our part. And it's tragic because actually there are a lot of good ideas out there. I mean, you see it again with the young. We're you know, in potential climate crisis. The world's actually a fairly filthy place, and the young are coming up with such amazing inventions to stop this and to heal the world. And what's happening? It's being stopped by bureaucracy and everything else.
Yeah,
we need to get out of that paradigm because the past can offer us a way to the future.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. It's something that I repeat quite often on the show, because you do get comments from people saying, look, we've got so many problems right now. Like, what's the point in focusing on all of this ancient history stuff? And I understand that perspective because, like you said, the world is a turbulent, chaotic place right now. And there's a lot of free-floating anxiety about the geopolitics and about, you know, technology and pollution and so many things. But when you do look into this ancient past and you do start seeing these anomalies that hint towards actually something so grand, something so incredible, I think that that is, one, a reason for some of the suppression, if we want to get into the idea that we are a controlled species by a very select few people who have been over time modeling the way that humanity progresses, which does seem to be evident when you look at, again, the powers of theological architectures rising up and becoming the, you know, the spokespeople of how God should be seen and how spirituality should be viewed, and then how science progresses. You know, there is certainly that element that seems to be in play, but like you said, the younger generations, there is a resistance to this status quo. Now there is more of a resistance to these institutionalized ideas and the baggage of this monotheistic kind of architecture that's been erected for so long. The rigidity of it no longer matches up with the fluidic nature of our reality, because we're in such a dynamic and fast changing world. So yeah, like, it can be intense and anxiety ridden to, you know, look at where we are. But when you look back at what we could have been, it might fill us with hope. It might fill us with an ability to go, actually, this is what humanity could get back to. And what an incredible moment in time it must have been when you see just these, you know, these shattered and scattered and scarred and marked remains of this incredible time. And it's incredible now just seeing it. What was it like in its glory, in its fruition? You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, this is what's so astonishing. When you look at the reconstruction of Egypt, for instance, we walk around temples today, we're looking at the ruins. They're silent testimony to the past. They're half constructed from what they were. And then when you look at them as they were, And if anybody can get hold of VR when they're in Egypt, I recommend you wear one of these things to see it as it was, because we're not talking here about a society obsessed with death. They were actually obsessed with life. They were living, breathing, beautiful people. These temples were resonating 24 hours a day to music. They were painted. They were painted in bright colors. We're talking here about a civilization that lasted for 5,000 years. You don't do that without wisdom. There's no empire on the world scale, historic scale, that's gone anywhere near 5,000 years. There's very few that have gone anywhere near 500 years. And so you kind of think to yourself, gosh, you know, we started from this peak and now we're probably very much in a trough. Actually, I think we should be thankful, because being in a trough is now a time for utter transformation.
Yeah, it means we can only have a peak, right? We've got to go to a peak.
Yeah, and you know, it's in civilizational terms, but also in terms of who we are ourselves, you know? One thing I will say, by the way, that comes to mind is I went to central Mexico many years ago and looked at the pyramids of the sun and moon at Teotihuacan. Mm.
I'd love to go there.
And then one day I was actually found myself eating fish and chips in a British restaurant, and they were serving sea salt. It was a variety of sea salt called Maldon sea salt. And as I put the spoon in, I saw a pyramid, because the salt crystal from the sea salt is actually pyramidal in structure.
Right.
And I was rather, you know, amazed by this, and it shows you a part of my obsession at the time when I was writing the book. I took the pyramid home and I put it under a microscope and I looked at it. And when you compared it to the pyramid of the moon, it had the same terracing. It had the same angle of declination. It had the same height proportions. And I thought, goodness me.
What?
Now, salt is one of those human things that if you have to eat, you have no life. Okay, the Roman soldiers were paid in salt, hence the word salary, from the Latin sel or sal. Okay, not only that, but we owe our civilization to the Mesopotamian river mouths, the estuaries, wherein grew barley. And barley actually lives on part fresh water, part salt water. Okay, so it lives on salt. We made barley water to give to children at very young age, babies, so that it could actually liquefy the solids in their gut that came from dairy food. So without barley, we wouldn't have actually evolved a gut that could actually eat dairy. Okay, now here's the thing. The hero god, including gods like Osiris, Adonis, Attis, Tammuz, it's an infinite amount of gods. And also the god Quetzalcoatl in Central America, whose symbol was maize, corn, okay? Barley was actually used to actually create the first mass wafer, okay? And in Egypt, the heads of barley would actually be woven together as a corn dolly and left outside the pyramid at the end of the season, so that at the inundation of the Nile the next season, the water would hit, it would go green, Osiris was risen, okay?
I'm pretty sure they still do that. The kids run around with them and sell them for a few Egyptian dollars.
But barley, when it's fertile in its green phase with the very long whiskers, it's only fertile twice a day at that period because it's hit by earth resonance, okay? Which is approximately 32 vibrations per second. When the sun comes up just over the horizon, those stamens begin to vibrate, which then stimulate the ova ready for fertilization by bees and goodness knows what else. The ancients knew this. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Latin name for barley is Hordeum sativum, which when you translate that means the Lord God cultivated. Okay? So again, we're talking here about, you know, cereals, cereal gods, etc., etc. And it's just the most remarkable thing. Everything has its place, its part.
Yeah, and these correlations, in fact, it's similar to where I visited recently, and you brought up Newgrange in Ireland, and I couldn't help but see similarities at the temple sites in Malta, where I was recently visiting, and like Hal Tajín and some of these other temples, you get these same spiral motifs, the same trilithon stone doorways and structures, and some of them even exhibit like forms of acoustic engineering, most notably the Hypogeum, the subterranean temple complex. What do you see in terms of Malta and the connections there? Because they also seem to have been a people, from what we know, which is very little, that venerated the natural flows, the natural harmonies. Agriculture seemed to be very important. So, does Malta tie into your acoustic
Yeah,
research?
very much so, I have to say. And I think a lot of it is based upon the cycles of the Earth, trying to understand them. I think it's not just astronomical, as archaeologists just say today. It's definitely to do with the actual experience of the place itself. And therefore, going into these places and communing with the Earth herself. And then, obviously, understanding more about what life is, where it's come from. Because at that stage, in proceedings, we are still very, very largely umbilically connected to planet Earth. Not so much today, of course, because we've now gone to the moon, we're seeking to go elsewhere. It seems as if we are separating ourselves from the Earth, but not yet realizing that we are still attached. We're kind of going through the teenage phase, if you like, you know. But going back all those years ago, we are still a babe in arms. That's what I find so profound about the end of Kubrick's wonderful, groundbreaking science fiction film, 2001 Space Odyssey. At the end, you see the Earth transformed into a child in the womb. Because that's basically what we are. That's what we're looking at, you know. And the whole idea that, you know, of cereal crops, the celebration of life, the way in which we entangle ourselves within it, and that it's entangled within us, that's what true spirituality is about. And let's not forget that the word spirit in Latin means wind, breath, or air, without which you would have no acoustical qualities. So again, it all ties into language. It all ties into an understanding of the communion that language gives us with our home planet and with each other.
Are there any other acoustic sites you've been to that we haven't mentioned that are worth bringing up?
Yeah, I would say to your guests, your listeners that you know, they couldn't beat going to a decent Gothic cathedral. I would mention the Lady Chapel at Ely Cathedral in Cambridgeshire. It is simply staggering. It is beyond belief, actually. To my mind, it's the second greatest sound chamber on the planet. It is that acoustically wonderful. Obviously, Wells Cathedral, any cathedral. Chartres Cathedral is always worth visiting. And yeah, just go into these places. You don't have to be a Christian to enjoy them, but just see them in the wider context of what they are and what they've done. Because they transformed Europe and they have brought us to where we are now. And the present crisis we're in, again, crisis, a word related to cross, upon which the hero across the world in world's mythologies is crucified in order to draw down knowledge. The crisis we're in now, you know, it's a crisis, I think, of identity about our place in history. It's been inculcated through these places, and now we're going through a huge change. But I think we need these places now to reattach to them to understand how we can get to where we're going to go. I think it's terribly important.
I think another place that just speaks to how far back in time some of these acoustic temple sites go is Chavín-Tahuanta in Peru. Have you been out there?
I haven't actually, and I want to go. I'm envious of you for having been there, but I.
I haven't been there. I've just researched it, and I've looked into what was discovered there. They even found these conch shells that had been purposefully engineered to produce a unique harmonic. And the infrasound, the reverberatory infrasound inside these subterranean chambers has been proven. You know, it's 100% an acoustic chamber of some form.
Well, it's a worldwide phenomenon, you know, and again, the key to understanding it, I think, would be to look at the mythology as well, because it's an expression of what these places were built for. So, you know, we have that extraordinary phenomenon. I mean, not all of these civilizations appeared at the same time, But when they did appear, they had the same strand running through them. It's absolutely fascinating. It really is.
Well, that's the thing is, like, you know, if you had, and I've said this before, if you had this same form of thematic sequencing in biology or in chemistry, this would be called a shared ancestry. But because it's mythology or motifs, even though they're distributed globally and there's correlations, it's coincidence. It's to be dismissed. That doesn't make any sense academically.
No, it makes no sense at all. And in fact, it's highly illogical because, again, the word myth in the original Greek, mythein, it's myth with E-I-N on the end. It means that which is spoken. So from myth, we get mystery. And where do we have mystery? We have it in these beautiful places where it hits us individually. So no, it is connected and it's connecting us to the wider cosmos. This is the phenomenon. And by dismissing it on an individual basis, we're dismissing our whole modus operandi for being here. Mm-hmm. That's what's so absurd about it. And as I said to you, we've got to use logic to expand our experience of the world, not to limit it. And too often that happens now.
Yeah, and too much disregarding, I would say, of oral traditions of indigenous cultures, because, like you said, myth, it's the passing down of the voice, of the word, of the oral tradition. And so many of these, you know, whether it be Native American or the Amazonian basin or in Peru, the shamans, the wisdom keepers, there has been a maintaining of knowledge that is orally preserved, which the Western, you know, historians and archaeologists will laugh away and disregard. We don't take it seriously enough. And it's just an interesting thing. A little aside is like an example of this is Graham Hancock and how Graham Hancock was treated by the mainstream media when he put out Ancient Apocalypse, and he was lambasted by the media. He was even called a racist for these ideas and promoting far-right ideology, when in reality what he was actually doing is he was listening to the indigenous story, the story that they actually have. When, you know, the Spanish went over to Peru, they just decided that the Inca constructed Sacsayhuaman or some of these other places, Ollantambo, these amazing megalithic constructs. No way that it could have been constructed with bronze tools by the Inca civilization. And yet we take that story from, you know, the Spanish chroniclers who went over, and we just say, yeah, they were right, that's what it is. And then the indigenous cultures go, well, actually, we have an oral tradition of a lost civilization, and this goes way further back into, no, we don't need to do that. And then Graham Hancock says we should listen to their stories and gets called a racist. It's a very backwards world we live in, and we have to kind of, like, you know, balance this strange tightrope. Like you said, a recovering academic, it can be so dry and disregarding in that particular area, very stagnant.
Well, I mean, you know, let's not forget we're still living in the shadow of the end of the Second World War. And the reason academics throw that argument out is because, of course, the Nazis went with the Ahnenerbe to Tibet to try and find the origins of the Aryan race. And so they see anything that's bears any similarity to this as the same racist phenomenon. And of course, they know jolly well that that's simply not the case. Let's not forget one thing. On the 6th of May, 1945, we suddenly heard of the language phenomenon called Indo-European, okay, the root of all languages. But on the 5th of May, that language theory was known as Indo-Germanic. The very theory the Germans were using, the Nazis were using, to prove their Aryan racist theories. It never went away. The same academe is using that same theory. Okay, and Professor Lord Renfrew, the distinguished and eminent archaeologist at Cambridge University, has pointed this out. So it's very rich of them to make those accusations. And like you, I think that it's a profound mistake to dismiss the source documents, even if it's oral history, because at the end of the day, it comes back to haunt us, you know. There's a story of an SAS man about 20 years ago on an exercise somewhere in the jungles of Borneo, I think. Anyway, with his team, he had an accident. He fell over and he split his leg from the knee to the thigh. Okay. Now, in such humid conditions, you're talking here about a death sentence. Okay. About 2 days later, because so vast was the rainforest, they got to a native habitation, and by this time he was delirious. And so the shaman medicine man said, "Leave it with me," you know, in pointed language, and wrapped his leg around with vine leaves, sewed it together with stitches made from some plant or other, used his own urine to clean the wound, got maggots to clean out the dead flesh, and then applied this extraordinary noxious substance, which the other members of the SAS team said, "No, no, we can't do that. That's going to kill him." And at the insistence of the medicine man, they thought, "Well, we've got nothing to lose." About 24 hours later, he was out of his coma. The leg was healing very nicely. Thank you very much indeed. They got back to camp. His leg was almost fully healed. He was walking on it. And the great thing was, when they tried to locate the village, they were unable to, because it was so deeply in the rainforest. Now, this is a classic case. If they had taken the modern view, "Oh, these are natives, we're just going to, they're simpletons, we're just going to ignore them," that man would have lost his life. You know? And yet, these are people who have been living there probably for thousands of years. They know their location. And just look at the work of Jeremy Narby, DNA and the Cosmic Serpent. Out with his guides in the Amazon rainforest, looking for new pharmaceutical, plant sources, etc. And one day they're sitting down by a campfire, and he says, "Well, you obviously know the jungle very well." And they turn around and said, "We've never been here before in our lives." And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" They said, "Oh, well, we take this substance made from leaves, and it tells us where to go." So he took some, and the next morning woke up and having, I think, a bit of a hangover from it all, and he's taken loads of drawings of what he saw. And when he got back to his laboratory back here in England, he found that what he'd drawn was the plant DNA. Now that's extraordinary. Again, it comes back to that whole thing of drawing down the knowledge, etc., and the memory and writing it down. The gift of us, or to us, sorry, from wisdom of language and the ability to draw, so we can make records, we don't give it the proper credit. So, this has allowed us to develop our society and our civilization the way it has. And
corrections need to be made.
Yes, exactly. You see, and these so-called native people are actually just brilliant.
Very much, I can't help but think of Avatar and things like that. Fundamentally, just connected to nature in such an intuitive way that it's incomprehensible to the mush-brained Western mind that's just so disconnected from all of this. I mean, my goodness, even someone like myself, and I would even argue yourself, who's researching and connecting these dots, we're still so saturated with the programming of our Western world, of the people around us, of the information that we're saturated with on a daily basis. It's an uphill struggle for everyone.
It is, definitely. I totally agree with you there. Unfortunately, I've got a very good sense of humor. And humor means you have to see both sides of the argument in the instantaneous moment. And in that bit where they overlap, you see the truth. That's humor. And that's the way to get out of this, by being funny. The fact that in the West, we're trying to...
That's a very British Monty Python-esque response. I like that.
Yeah, well, because basically humor links you to those with opinions
that
won't necessarily share, with you. And so therefore it's a unifying communion aspect of both of language and concept, which something which shamans in ancient societies to this day still understand and appreciate. And yes, we are getting more mush brained because we keep using these things, I've seen people walking along Oxford Street here in London, where I'm staying, crossing Oxford Street on their phones like this. I've seen three people in the past 2 years knocked over by cars.
Well, that's also why it's so easy for these moped gangs to just come and swipe your phone, because nobody's got any situational awareness anymore.
And here's the best bit, Jay. I've seen them getting up on their phone still and walking off. And there's the panicking motorist thinking, "Oh my God, I may have killed somebody." And these people must be heavily bruised, but they're in that state. what they're not understanding is that it's bliss being in that state, so use it to draw down knowledge.
Right.
It's that simple. So, you know, the world is a fascinatingly and fabulously funny place. And we are going through amazing change, but I actually think it's for the positive.
I think it was Mark Twain that might have said, if you want to tell the truth, make people laugh, otherwise they will kill you.
Quite right. Quite right.
And it is a very true statement. David, this has been a fascinating conversation. I know everyone listening and watching is going to find this absolutely brilliant. If you want to let people know either where they can find you or if you have anything you'd like to promote, please do so. Links will be in the description box below for your books. It's been fantastic.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on board, and look forward to seeing you all again sometime soon.